So the Buddha said he saw an ancient path traveled by the enlightened ones of the past, and what is that ancient path? The Noble Eightfold Path, and that Eightfold Path are kind of interface with the world, speech, action, livelihood, central. And so, there are two wings of awakening, wisdom and love. We've been alluding to this, wisdom and love. And just for me and my own practice, I've sort of become, they're distinct, right? Wisdom, love. But I've become suspicious of any insight that does not catalyze love. Love itself levels distinctions across time and place and power. We become, an ancient phrase, a true person of no rank. A true person of no rank. It's maybe redundant. True person of no rank. And sila, this sila samadhi panya, the ethical trainings, is sort of the central way that we express the path in our life. This is like where practice interfaces with the world. And the Dharma, in this tradition, sila is generally defined in the negative, as in what one abstains from. We took the precepts, we agreed to abstain from killing, stealing, causing overt harm, sexual misconduct. And just that is actually quite radical. Maybe you didn't even notice it. It didn't feel effortful, but it's actually, if even a significant number of people undertook this training, that's really like earth shaking in its implications. But is that the end of our obligation to others? Is that the end of our debt to others? Does the bliss of blamelessness entail more than abstaining from overt harm? Yeah, the phrase, that beautiful phrase, the bliss of blamelessness, the kind of delight of non-regret. Does the bliss of blamelessness entail more than abstaining from harm? And this is a renunciate path. We like a little easy to lose sight of, like that the renunciation is at the heart of this, kind of like beating heart of this path. And what does that entail for our ethical life, for our debt to one another? What, in other words, does beauty look like in the ethical sphere? And for some decades now, really since college, reading a book, I've been preoccupied with that question. Is my life defensible? Is my moral life defensible? Is it justifiable? How much do I actually owe to others? And I've been sort of like living in a certain way with some measure of cognitive dissonance, some measure of living with the sense of like, well, I don't know if I can justify my life. Maybe I owe actually much more than I tend to imagine. And I've been kind of almost haunted by that. And that willingness to be haunted has catalyzed at least some change. There's a philosopher, Parfit, who kind of didn't come at the self from a kind of meditative perspective, but came, you know, from a kind of, you know, analytic philosophical approach, and wound up in some conclusions that echo the Buddha quite closely. And he argued that there is some measure of continuity across time, you know, myself now, my future self, there's some measure of continuity, but that continuity is less morally significant than we imagine. We prioritize that to an unreasonable degree. And so we're separated from, we could say, we're separated from our future selves by time and from other people by space. And why is it that we find we so dramatically prioritize the distance across time rather than across space? Suffering is a state of self-absorption. The nature of suffering is to be self-absorbed. And I don't use that word in like a pejorative way, but that is what suffering does to us. That is, or maybe that is suffering. It's a kind of absorption in the melodrama of self. And as we suffer less, energy is freed up. And that energy, because it's not going into the maintenance of the self system, naturally goes to the world. And freedom is yoked to responsibility. Enlightenment has costs. And waking up is always waking up to more. So Maya Angelou says, do the best you can until you know better. Then when you know better, do better. Like, okay, do I know better? Dogen should therefore cease from practice based on intellectual understanding, pursuing words and following after speech, and learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself. I don't know much about that tradition, the lineage of Dogen, but that phrase always moved me, the backward step. And in a way, I feel like we're being invited to take a kind of backwards ethical step as individuals, society. And part of the kind of growing pains of ethical maturation, the development of our sila, is some sense of, yeah, there are growing pains. And that entails a willingness to be, you know, to be disoriented and to sense the kind of fissures in our own ethical life, what we think we owe, what we're doing, what we're not doing. And I'm interested in all of that, but I'm also interested in like how this is sustainable, because it all feels like too much, too much. You know, the phrase is those two words, too much, sort of like maybe that's synonym for dukkha, too much. It's the classic definition of stress. Kind of the resources of the body are overwhelmed by the environmental demands, exceeded. And we look out at the world and we have something that a philosopher described as a moral vertigo. Moral vertigo, meaning there's so much to be done. There's such profound limitations on our power. Not clear. Where do I fit in? How do I help? This band, I've been listening, kind of like basically the only thing I've been listening to for like 19 years. To the chagrin of everyone in my life. And the band is, the name is The National, and they've been described as Beyonce for depressed white people. Like, yes, please. And new album titled Laugh Track, and it's like, you know, that laugh track that you get used in sitcoms or whatever, where they pipe in the kind of like, you know, a recording of audience or whatever laughing, right? And you know, if you actually just listen to a laugh track, it would sound like on its own, it would sound so absurd, and it's sort of like. Yeah, it's not working, you know, the laugh track, and so, but it testifies in a sense to the allure of like sleepwalking through life, you know, turn on the laugh track. And song, I'll read some lyrics, is about personal psychic pain. But it's you can read it at the societal level too. It says, and the lead singer writes the songs with his wife, you know, of a long time, and it's like for like six albums, I've been thinking they're getting divorced, but they're not, but. So they write, losing my momentum, losing my mind, not enough to mention, not enough time. I can't even say what it's about. All I am is shreds of doubt. And you don't know how to deal with me. You don't know how that feels. It all comes apart so easily, and you're running out of ideas. Everything melted in less than a week. Watching it felt like forever. The light started dimming, and then they went out. Heaven came down like a blanket. I can't even say what it's about. All I am is shreds of doubt. So turn on the laugh track. Everyone knows you're a wreck. You're never this quiet. Your smile is cracking. You just haven't found what you're looking for yet. Turn on the laugh track. We'll see if it changes the scene. Maybe this is just the funniest version of us that we've ever been. I think our feet are going to slip. I think our hands are going to shake. I think our eyes are going to cry. I think our hearts are going to break. Maybe we'll never lighten up. Maybe this isn't going to quit. I think it's never coming back. Maybe we've always been like this. So turn on the laugh track. So how do we actually kind of persist sustainably? How does the heart not, like, if we're open, if we want to be open to the world, how does the heart not wither in the heat of that sun? And, you know, dukkha has displaced dukkha, which has displaced other dukkha, and it's hard to keep track of all the things we might worry about. And because there's dukkha everywhere, there must be sila everywhere. But the pain of the world somehow may be a function of our of media and information flows, but it seems unrelenting and unsustainable. Maybe we've always been like this, but it seems unsustainable. And there is some recognition that humanity is kind of playing with fire, in the sense of we're now powerful enough species that we threaten our very own survival. And technology's done, you know, incredible things, but it has also centrally functioned to scale greed, hate, and delusion. And that scaling is now enough to threaten us in a deep way. And so we do seem to be living. It's hard to look at the paper and not see, like, which I have not been doing on this retreat because my heart's too sensitive, and I just want to be in the flow of retreat with you, actually. But you look at the paper and it feels like we're living in some kind of decisive time. And maybe that's what every generation thinks. And maybe that's just the grandiosity of each generation thinks, like, well, we're the important ones, you know, where this is an inflection point. But we may actually be, you know, these 100 years or something. Toby Ord, the threats to humanity and how we address them define our time. The advent of nuclear weapons posed a real risk of human extinction in the 20th century. With the continued acceleration of technology and without serious efforts to protect humanity, there's strong reason to believe that the risk will be higher this century and increasing with each century that technological progress continues. Because these anthropogenic, human-generated risks outstrip all natural risks combined, they set the clock on how long humanity has left to pull back from the brink. I'm not claiming extinction is the inevitable conclusion of scientific progress or even the most likely outcome. What I am claiming is there has been a robust trend towards increases in the power of humanity, which has reached a point where we pose a serious risk to our own existence. Recognizing that people matter equally wherever they are in time is a crucial next step in the ongoing story of humanity's moral progress. Our own generation is but one page in a much longer story, and that our most important role may be how we shape or fail to shape that story. This approach was animated by a moral reorientation toward the vast future that existential risks threaten to foreclose. Ord suggested that humanity might be in a kind of adolescent phase, you know, like where adolescent phase, where an adolescent body is as healthy and resilient as it will ever be, and yet the morbidity, mortality risk go up a lot during adolescence. It's a dangerous time. And for us, where are we in all of this? we read the news, we hear a siren, we think about whatever, the suffering on the street corner, the suffering in our own family, and it's like it all pings off one another, and the mind kind of collapses. There's no space. Hell is no space, as we said. And in the absence of kind of like a deep love, moments like that can collapse into nihilism or frenzied action. And the Buddha was worried about nihilism, was worried clearly about the, you know, in a way, a kind of misconstrual of the teachings on emptiness, the way that the path, you know, can be very close to wholesome onward leading and then takes a little, can get a little sideways, and when every experience is exchangeable with every other, when experience has no weight, when nothing is impinging on the mind, there can be can lead us to think that nothing matters. But emptiness is suffering still matters, and the kind of face of emptiness is love. And so we find our way. No, it's not that nothing means anything. You know, emptiness is the path, the middle path between everything means everything and nothing means anything. And so we want to act, but we are confronted by our almost complete helplessness and get frenzied. And a lot of what I think we're doing, you know, in Dharma practice and, you know, in our engagement with the world is sorting out our relationship to helplessness. And so this is a kind of central feature of our life. How many moments just in retreat are we confronted with the utter impotence of our wishes and willfulness? Maybe we say dukkha and helplessness are synonyms. And so that doesn't have to, but often does, break our heart. People cry for many reasons, as it turns out, you know, like research on that. People cry for many reasons, but one of the main reasons people cry is out of a sense of helplessness. And it maybe makes some sense evolutionarily that is like, oh yeah, it's a plea. It's a request. I need you. I need your help. And so we cry, others cry. But we're not sure anyone's coming, you know. And all of that can kind of scramble us emotionally. And so sometimes feel stuck in that. All this care, all the limitations of our power. And we can even sort of like can undercut our faith in practice, or sometimes even practice feels self-indulgent when we're caught in that bind, in that collapse. So we're stuck, and another song, Tom Waits, Hold On. sings down by the Riverside Motel, it's 10 below and falling. By a 99-cent store, she closed her eyes and started swaying. But it's so hard to dance that way when it's cold and there's no music. Oh, your old hometown's so far away, but inside your head there's a record that's playing. A song called Hold On, Hold On. Babe, you gotta hold on. Take my hand, I'm standing right here. You gotta hold on. So much to care about, so much to love, and a nervous system that feels very much like it was not designed to care this much or this many in the face of the kind of ungovernable nature of samsara. And so we need love, yeah, love, serving love, and rest, true rest, to actually balance our compassion with a sense of like true rest. And equanimity, you know, sometimes kind of, it's not, you know, there's that line from T.S. Eliot, teaches to care and not to care. I've been drawn to that line, and I don't know if the not to care is a good way of describing the restfulness of equanimity. Equanimity more feels like it's actually still care, it's still love, but it's love in the face of the endlessness of suffering. The heart open, but resting, deeply resting in the limitations of its own wishes. And so, I want my suffering to be efficient, you know? Like, that's what Thomas Merton was asked, like, why do you do so much retreat, you know? And his response was to suffer efficiently, yeah? That's not on the flyers here, you know, but that's for real. To suffer efficiently in the sense of like, you know, there's some loops of suffering. You look back on your life and it's like, oh my goodness, like that was like so cyclical. Like, and maybe it felt necessary in those times, but I look back and it was like, ah, that was just a kind of whirlpool of dukkha, and it didn't lead anywhere. It was inefficient suffering. And here we're trying to suffer efficiently, and in our lives we're trying to spend our love well and care in ways that are actually matter, that are not purely depleting and ineffectual. And so we can have this sense of like it's morally negligent for me not to be plugged into this and that and the other, but we do have to like calibrate what is the capacity of our own heart, where can we spend our love well, and what is this just vague sense of guilt that to take some protection is morally negligent. But we want to look because where our pain serves nothing, it's better to take shelter. We're learning to open to helplessness, and in that case, often all you can do is grieve, grieve. And grief is a kind of like the flavor of the growing pains of ethical evolution. As we evolve, as we moralize, meaning like we endow more and more phenomena with moral weight, more and more people with moral weight. As we do that, we do come against our, that process of waking up involves some measure of grieving. And that grief, a life kind of divorced of grief, is really unimaginable to me. Some measure of tenderness, and sometimes that's the only consolation we have, is that sense of the heaviness mixed with some flavor of love. We're learning to open to that, for that to actually grow our love. And we're also learning where we can help. The grief becomes more supple, more fluid. It has less of a tail. It has, you know, it's like something about the emotional system over years, decades, Dharma practice. It's like things get digested very quickly. And so the kind of temporal rhythms of our emotional life changes quite a bit. And sense of like the comet tail of grief from that last moment into this one, it's like the tail gets much shorter. And so it means that even like very poignant feeling in this moment doesn't leave a kind of residue in the next. And so it doesn't, we're not kind of digesting that over a long period of time. It arises, it's done, it does its work. So it's less fatigue. And we look where we can be of use, and our love, it starts locally, right here, you know, in very, very pedestrian ways. I was reading earlier this year, reading research, Kumar and colleagues, and on kindness and random acts of kindness, like giving up a cup of hot chocolate at a skating rink, you know, that I think was the experiment, and just, you know, randomly, right? And there were a couple findings. So one was like the giver of the hot chocolate and the receiver both felt quite good. The giver systematically underestimated how good the receiver would feel. And the giver underestimated how good the receiver would feel, in part because the giver was focused on the monetary value of the thing rather than the affective emotional warmth of giving. And when I saw that, I was like, that rang very true. Because if I were assigned to give a hot chocolate to somebody, I would be very bashful and just like, I'm so sorry, it's not a venti, you know, like, or like, I can picture my shame. It's like, it's not, it's very close to the surface, you know, and it's like, but if somebody did that for me, if they got me a hot chocolate, like, I would like remember that for like a decade or something, you know, and so, the study got written up in the newspaper, and then I like read through the comments, you know, and it was like kind of amazing, you know, like, you know, they just start with like, when I was 10 years old, you know, and then they would share this gesture of kindness, or on the worst day of my life. That was very, very beautiful. And there's something about this time, these kind of like the seasons of grieving, that's made me so sensitive to goodness. And a lot of the Dharma is just that, just like really becoming calibrated to goodness. And I talk about, kind of limitations of our wishes, but then we do look, where can we be useful? And Will McCaskill saying, kind of sort of making a case for essentially for the redistribution of wealth. So imagine saving a single person's life. You pass a burning building, kick the door down, rush through the smoke and the flames, drag a young child to safety. If you did that, it would stay with you for the rest of your life. If you save several people's lives, you'd think your life was really special. You'd be in the news, be a hero. But we can do more than that. According to the most rigorous estimates, the cost to save a life in the developing world is about $3,400. That's, so they use like medical statistics, like the number needed to treat. How many people do you have to give an intervention to and a vaccine or protect from malaria in order to save a life? $3,400. Getting actually to be more expensive because the low-hanging fruit is it's there are not as many people dying needlessly. We lose track of that. It's getting actually harder to save a life, and that's a beautiful thing. But the estimate, this, you know, $3,400, small, that's, of course, a lot of money, but a small amount that many in affluent countries could donate each year while maintaining about the same quality of life. We could save a life every working year of our lives. Donating is not as glamorous as kicking down the door, burning building, but the benefits are as great. Through the simple act of sharing resources with the most effective charities, organizations, we have the power to save dozens of lives. That's pretty amazing. This has been important to me as I kind of like marinate in that sense of helplessness or limitation, just the spectacle and horror and tragedy of greed, hate, delusion writ large. And so the more kind of bewildered and crushed by the kind of like endlessness of suffering, the more we can give, you know, not maybe money, maybe time, maybe something, energy. And then we kind of like come up against some edge of what feels like okay to give, and maybe we keep giving, but at some point we hit a point and it's like, okay, that's all I can give, heart, money, whatever it is. And you stop, and when you stop, you know you've stopped. And there's something about knowing you've stopped cuts through that flailing sense of helplessness. It's like, okay, I stopped. I did what I actually feel willing in this moment, at least, to do. Now, let me rest. And when we rest, we really rest. We're not doing kind of like half compassion, half equanimity. It's like, no, totally loving and then totally resting. It's like some way in which we need to firewall our heart from the active form of care, of compassion. Because when it kind of leaks in, you know, leaks through that firewall, then that there's something, it's like we're always spending cycles, like in some measure of just helplessness. And so we want to explore the relationship between between love and equanimity. Equanimity maybe, you know, is a kind of counterbalancing force to compassion, and an attempt. Our equanimity is, it like highlights the impurities and entanglements in our compassion. You know, said that the Buddhist path is like the middle path between unwholesome extremes, self-mortification, self-indulgence. But it's also the middle path between wholesome extremes, compassion, equanimity. You can never march to the beat of one Dharma drum. It always needs to be rebalanced. It's improvisational. The nature of wisdom is improvisational. And so there's something about equanimity that, you know, the way whatever you burn metal and like the impurities rise, and you can kind of see that, it's almost like equanimity, you know, burns up our compassion and highlights the bits of it that are kind of entangled or compulsive or grandiose. Because Dharma love is the love that is devoid of the stress of possessiveness. You know, it's a love that doesn't actually need to control, and it feels frightening and so good to relinquish that. And so the kind of ways in which there is a kind of subtle grandiosity creeps into our compassion, and equanimity reminds us, no, the First Noble Truth will not be dismantled. And in me, you know, it's like sometimes my efforts to help, it has a kind of compulsive quality, or it's the intolerance of the suffering of the other rather than love in the face of suffering. And so we interrogate the nature of our compassion. We purify it with equanimity. And as we become more and more free, the pain of the world, as we heal, the pain of the world does not resonate with our wounds, but with our heart. A time of anxiety, uncertainty. Yeah, and some Max alluded to this kind of anxiety, a certain kind of intolerance of uncertainty. At the micro scale of our life and the macro scale of, you know, civilization, it's we do know how the story ends. We know how all stories end. The Buddha foretold that everything changes. Everything changes. And there's a very famous teaching from Ajahn Chah. It's kind of like, you know, holding up his like beloved tea mug and saying, this cup, which was not broken, this cup is already broken. This cup, which holds my tea admirably, it's already broken. I know its nature. And so you kind of trace that out. Cup is already broken. The fire has already burned this land. Sun's already faded out. I'm already dead. You just take it into the heart and see what, let it rattle around, see what it does. And then I think when that's clanked around the heart enough, we met that with enough courage and strength and softness, the urgency of love becomes more clear. Our love, sober, tender. And the question is just, how will we spend it? Sit. Offer this for your consideration. And as always, it's up to you, to your discernment, to inquire what's useful and worthy of contemplation, practice, and what can you leave behind these words. Really just a way of telling a story about my own heart with the hope that something in it resonates as a benefit for you.